Today is Wednesday. It's June 14th, 2023. It's 2:40 in the afternoon. Today is also Flag Day. It's also Donald Trump's birthday. And the Wordle word today is crime. Hey, I'm John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can hear portions of this broadcast on WGN Radio Saturday nights at 8 o'clock. Listen to me weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute. You can listen to my podcast, America's Talking.
My name is Mark Jacob. I'm a former Metro editor at the Chicago Tribune, just a plain old freelance writer now.
Who's working on a fascinating book that we won't tell you anything about right now.
Later. Boy, you won't be able to get me to stop talking about it.
He's paranoid that if we tell you about the book, that you'll run out and write a book about the very same thing and get it published before him.
Exactly. And that's not an irrational view. That's actually...
I run into that all the time with authors. They go, but I don't want to talk about it. I go, trust me. Jacob has spent years researching this. It's not like you're going to get ahead of him.
But artificial intelligence could get ahead of me. I mean, you could just – it could in 30 minutes do what I've taken 2.5 years for.
Yeah, but it would sound like an eighth grade term paper. You know, Abraham Lincoln was a president from Illinois. He wore a black hat.
I just watched the movie Synecdoche, New York this weekend. Have you guys ever seen that?
Yeah.
Charlie Kaufman movie.
Yeah.
With Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Very strange.
And so he gets the MacArthur Genius Grant, and then he basically makes a play with actors of everybody in his own life that he works on for like 30 years. So I'm imagining Mark is writing sort of a story about all the things of his life.
We're going to talk about Donald Trump here in about 14 seconds, but just since we're on this tangent, I had a doctor on, child psychologist today. He said that he was recently at a meeting at the University of Illinois in Champaign, where computers are famous, and they were talking about artificial intelligence used in psychology, where you would talk to an AI screen, and it would do some sort of therapy with you, some talk therapy. He said that the avatar that would appear would change to a shape and hue that you could most relate to. So if I was a person of color, maybe I'm going to talk to an avatar that shares my hue, black, brown, white, whatever. And maybe I've got spiky hair. Maybe I've dyed it purple. Well, then maybe the avatar could have spiky purple hair and earrings too, or tattoos. It would sort of put you in the most comfortable zone. And then you would talk to a computer program, and it would feed back predicted sentences to you. And that would be a kind of therapy that would start the process. Eventually, human beings would oversee it. He said, this isn't here yet, but that's what they were talking about.
There's already great studies out now on ChatGPT-like large language models giving people diagnoses for illnesses and acting like a doctor. And the gap between ChatGPT and a regular – it was better on diagnosing almost everything.
Really?
Based on symptoms that were given to it. And the biggest difference, and this was what was most shocking to me to what you're talking about, the biggest difference in ChatGPT being better than the average doctor was bedside manner.
That I'm not that surprised about.
Well, the computer had limitless time, but it can't really. It was also sweeter, kind. Well,
nicer.
Yeah, it's not stressed. It doesn't have to get to somebody in room 14. I guess.
You know, but a friend of mine who's actually quite accomplished just ordered some AI bot to write a mini biography of himself, and it gave him a Pulitzer Prize that he never earned, and it also credited him with helping create Millennium Park, which he didn't. So I think there's a ways to go, and I'm just suspicious that AI, at least in the short term, is going to get where people think it's going to get.
Maybe in the short term, yeah.
I mean, you know, it's just, I do think that there is something about that a sentence written by a computer feels like a sentence written by a computer versus, you know, there's a human touch. There's just this warmth and, you know, just lack of, maybe it's even imperfection that makes something feel human and therefore kind of more comforting or more welcome to the recipient.
True to ChatGPT would be that then you would tell the computer, hey, I didn't win the Pulitzer Prize, and then it would argue with you, oh, yes, you did.
Yes, you did. Congratulations.
Yeah, exactly. Why are you lying to me? Yes, you did.
There's an amazing lecture. It doesn't have that many views on YouTube, and it's like the best lecture I've heard on ChatGPT. It's this economist named Tyler Cowen, who has a great podcast also, and it was with the London School of Economics. And he's an economics professor. He does tons of research in his day job. But the whole lecture is just about how to think about using it in your everyday life and how it might change things. And the heuristic that he used was treat it like an endless amount of research assistance and a dog. So you need to encourage it and talk to it in a way that says, you know, not just maybe write something about this, but write something about this in a way that a brilliant economist might write it, or in a way that a really empathetic psychotherapist may talk about it. And it's amazing. And it's astounding the difference between, you know, someone trying to just punch it in the face to get it to do better and you talking like a pet.
No, I can see how it could learn and get better at that. You know, I was very lucky many years ago to do a little mini fellowship in Japan, and I interviewed Masahiro Mori, who invented the concept of the Uncanny Valley. Are you familiar with the Uncanny Valley?
No, I'm not.
That is the idea that as androids, he was a robot scientist, a theorist, and when androids become more and more lifelike, human beings like the androids as they approach becoming lifelike, but when they get so close to lifelike that you can't tell the difference and don't know whether they're human or not, that creates something that he termed the uncanny valley, where the human being reacts with revulsion and fear that because you don't know what, you know, you're fine with an android that seems like a humanoid robot until you're not sure whether it's a person or not, and then you get scared and you don't know. And it's just a theory. It wasn't really like based on data or anything, but it was this interesting theory he came up with many years ago.
There's the best example that people use that I like of that is the movie Polar Express, the animated movie, where they look just almost like people, but they're not enough like it, so that something is creepy about it. And that's
right. And you can get even closer than that. But yes, that is actually pretty close to, you know, to human. And I just feel like that human beings want to know when computers are talking to them rather than people.
Yeah, I want a portal on their forehead or something, you know, just a USB. You know, and I talked to this child psychologist about the possibility that ChatGPT would replace or enhance the human beings that do what he does for a living. He said, I don't think that's such a bad thing. He said, we're not there. And I observed that I'm not against using science to help with biomedical problems. Why would I be against using data or technology to help me with psychological medical problems? Yesterday, the former president, Donald Trump, was arrested and criminally charged in a 37-count indictment. At its simplest, according to Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, Donald Trump lied about moving some boxes. Had he not lied about them, some with documents he was not permitted to have, he would not have had his fingerprint taken yesterday in a Miami courthouse. A crowd maybe as large as 5,000 people, mostly supporters, gathered outside. A couple hundred were able to see Donald Trump in a small restaurant where he stopped and prayed on his way back to his plane. Two candidates for president, Nikki Haley and Vivek Ramaswamy, have said that if Donald Trump is convicted and one of them becomes elected, they will pardon him. And the audience later that day, Illinois' Darren Bailey was in the Bedminster, New Jersey crowd where the president spoke about what had happened earlier. Bailey ran unsuccessfully against J.B. Pritzker for governor last year and might be vying for a seat in Congress. So here we are. What's next? Delaying tactics by Trump's legal team and then almost certainly a trial against what looks like hard to beat evidence.
Well, I mean, considering that how lucky they seem to have gotten in the draw of the judge, I think it could be a long time before this case comes to trial.
Who's the they that got lucky?
Oh, the Trump people. The team Trump got lucky by having Aileen Cannon, you know, their favorite judge, take the case. And you know, I don't think there's anything nefarious about it. It was luck of the draw, but she was ruling for them, you know, in matters of the special master and various other preliminary matters in this case, and got reversed, you know, twice in embarrassing fashion by an appellate court. And, you know, she has hardly any trial experience. She was one of the Trump judge appointees that people were wondering why the hell he, you know, named someone like that, unless it was because they were a loyalist. So I think that she will. I mean, who knows? She could just straighten up and fly right. There have been a lot of Trump appointees who have made good rulings. There was a good ruling in the Supreme Court with a Trump appointee, Brett Kavanaugh, just a week ago on the Alabama voting rights case.
Yeah,
so,
So
I'm not assuming that just because you're a Trump appointee, you're going to do bad things. But my prediction would be that this case moves very slowly, and that he gets charged with more serious things even than this before the year's out.
In Alabama, for instance.
No, I mean in Georgia.
Pardon me. Yeah.
Fulton County.
Yeah.
Fulton County, possibly, or maybe Jack Smith, the special counsel on the January 6th case. Either of those two things, to me, are probably even more serious than what he's been charged with now. And and they could also move faster, unless you get the same kind of draw of a judge.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, Austin, how grave all of this sounds when, as I said a moment ago, it's the business. You had the box here and then you moved it over there, and then the attorney said, we've got all the stuff here, and we didn't, and Trump knew it. But all of a sudden, this has taken on a lot of gravity. The president's supporters are saying this is trivial, and you didn't do this to Hillary Clinton, and you didn't do this to Joe Biden.
It's hard to predict what happens next, but I agree that because of the cartoonish nature of what he actually did, you can see him now brush off the charges in a similarly cartoonish fashion, right? It's just boxes saying the word indictment in the craziest way I've ever heard anyone say that word before.
Oh, I missed it. How did he run that?
I did everything right and they indicted me.
These were stored so recklessly in a bedroom and bathrooms and in ballrooms, and then spoken about so recklessly and telling people this is really highly classified stuff. And like Kid Rock is telling Rolling Stone he's seeing all of these documents at Mar-a-Lago. It's Trumpian, the way, like, the charges themselves. And I think that actually, in some sense, yeah, you almost wish the Fulton County case had come before this, because the evidence is so much less cartoonish. It's a phone call. It's sort of an intimidation. It's something that people understand is maybe wrong, whereas this, it's maybe easier to dismiss. It also comes on the heels of Alvin Bragg's charges, which I think were rightly criticized as a bit slapdash. But at the same time, you have a place like National Review, very conservative, was never super team Trump, but they have a really good piece, I thought, recently called The Trump Indictment is Damning. And they go through kind of all the whataboutisms and then just get to the nuts and bolts of the case. And this is a conservative publication talking about this. So I thought that's a good read for context on the right.
You know, the documents case, though, is, I mean, he's if you believe the evidence as laid out in the indictment, he's so obviously guilty. They just have him so red-handed now. It is almost cartoonish how red-handed they have him. They might as well have caught him with holding a sign that says, I stole documents. I mean, and there's that value to it as far as if you want justice, he's guilty of this, apparently, according to all the evidence that we've seen. So it's not going to be one of those things where, you know, people think he's railroaded. Now, that what the argument you're getting from people on the right, some of them, is, yeah, he's guilty, but you shouldn't charge him anyway. That called, you know, the whole Mike Pence thing where no one's above the law, but these are unique circumstances. In other words, someone's above the law is what he's saying when he says that. And I think that's a really dangerous thing. And I think even equating this to the Hillary stuff or the Biden stuff or the Pence stuff is both stupid and reckless and really minimizes what Trump did. I mean, this and Kevin McCarthy with his, well, bathroom doors have locks thing is just, I mean, it's just laughable. I mean, it's like, if this is the House Speaker, this is the third in line. You know, saying something that outrageously stupid, you know, that number one, bathroom door's locked from the inside, and and you think somebody can't pick a lock? What are you talking about? We're talking, you know, anyone could.
But, you know, we don't have any evidence that anything came of it. Like,
well, you know, but John, here's the thing. The intelligence services and the U.S. intelligence services if things came out of this, they're not going to tell you. They don't want you to know. If there was, if damage was done, they don't want you to know how much damage was done. So they're because that would cause even more damage. So that's the kind of trick bag we're in here.
Maybe so.
Is that we're not going to find out. We're never going to find out how much damage this did.
That's a tougher argument to make, that we don't know how grave the secrets were, because I think then that would also apply to other mishandling of classified documents or reckless handling or not enough security in those other cases. And there could be grave consequences as a result of that.
Right. I mean, but you don't have to, in order to convict him, you don't have to prove that there was any damage done.
Right.
The thing that I would say also is, if you are working for a government that's allied with the United States and you have intelligence, sensitive intelligence, are you more likely or less likely to share it with the United States after these revelations? I would argue less. And that is damage in itself. I think that our allies are scared of us now. And so I think regardless of whether you can point to one specific bit of intelligence being leaked one specific way and hurting the U.S. in some certain way, generally, you can say that the credibility of United States intelligence services has been diminished.
I've never been the president of the United States, but I was a little amazed at how much stuff he had and how carelessly it seemed to be just stacked up. Like, my basement is better organized, and we have those good plastic tubs you get at Target,
right,
and we put stuff in there. These are saggy boxes that are collapsing on their own weight.
And paper boxes, right?
So right, it's cardboard. And I'm thinking, so if these are your personal mementos, it's surprising that you don't care for them better. And if these are government documents that you're spiriting away, you'd really think that you would be careful with it. But he was none of that. He has since said that he just hadn't gone through all of them. One wonders if that'll be part of his defense, that the things that maybe the government discovered were things he himself didn't realize were there. You know, I can play this game of tennis with you guys all day long, and it would be more helpful, I think, to the court of public opinion if we could say, and therefore, look what happened. And there's no look what happened. I take your point, Mark. We may never know. Maybe we shouldn't know. Maybe even it doesn't matter. The fact that they existed in his bathroom is all we need.
But here's an interesting angle of all that, is that the documents that they cite in the indictment are not all the documents that they seized. So there are some documents that they're dealing with in this case that they have, that they have not made a part of any court case yet. One bit of speculation is that they're saving those, that those might have relate to Bedminster, or they might relate to some other venue that would allow them to file charges in a different jurisdiction than South Florida.
But do you guys see how none of this is going to change the opinion of 70 million people? It's papers in cardboard boxes that are at his house, but they should be somewhere else. At its most basic level, what's happened here? We don't have proof that anybody's capitalized on it or that he sold it. You can see how not only has he been able to raise money on this, but the gap between him and Joe Biden has grown in the last few weeks. The gap between him and Ron DeSantis has grown in the last few weeks. In a way, as much as he would protest all of this unfair treatment, this witch hunt, this is the best thing that's happened to his campaign. It's put more distance between him and the other guys, and the money's pouring in.
We've seen this for the last 2 years, really.
Yeah,
there's a martyrdom effect of all of this, and I think it deepens his supporters' feeling that Trump must be the front runner, or else this wouldn't be happening to him. And it's being fomented by his political opponents. And you see this isn't a uniquely American phenomenon, right? This happens all over the world.
The real danger here is things like what John Cass said the other day. Eric Zorn isn't here, but he pointed it out. Cass wrote, because it was Biden who ordered that his chief political rival, former Republican President Donald Trump, be criminally indicted in hopes of removing him as a political candidate in the 2024 election, isn't that election interference? Isn't that what third world nations do to their politics? That's John Cass, who was the Page 2 columnist for the Tribune for years.
As a former editor of John Cass for years, I edited Cass when I was at the Tribune. I'll say that's an idiotic statement. That's just I'm sorry, that's idiotic. That means that any criminal who committed any crime could immediately announce for that they're running for office, and nobody could prosecute them for the crime. Did the guy commit the crime? Did he do things that caused the prosecutors to say we have to charge this person with a crime? Yes. That really should be the only issue. If you really are going to have a government or a society in which you try to make everyone, no one exempt from the law. So I just don't buy that. Also, what Cass says in there is not true, that, you know, Biden ordered Trump charged. Now
that's the thing that bothers me the most about that sentence.
Well, I mean, and we'll get, you know, examine that a little bit. So, yes, Biden named Merrick Garland as attorney general. And yes, Merrick Garland named Jack Smith as special counsel. So, yes, it's in the Biden administration. And yes, ultimately, Biden is responsible. But according to what the White House says, believe him or not, Biden and his people found out about the indictment when everyone else did. You know, that they did not get any kind of back channel notification of that. And so, I mean, it's just oversimplifying it, and it's turning, and it's an attempt to turn it into a banana republic thing when it's not, to say that, you know, Biden is ordered his opponent to be arrested.
Suppose the evidence were more damning or more apparent to somebody. I mean, I don't know what the critical mass is to say, okay, we need to do this for some people. But I mean, then how does justice work? The president's not going to try the case. The attorney general's not going to try the case. So then they get a special prosecutor. Do you need the special prosecutor to appoint another special prosecutor? How much distance do we have to create from the administration in power to finally say, okay, this is insulated from any interference? Cass said it was Biden who ordered his chief political rival, former President Trump, be criminally indicted. Is that even true? But if nothing else, you've got a grand jury, at least a simple majority of those people said there's enough evidence. I know the bar is very low to grand jury, but
very low. Yeah. It's so, the old what they say about indicting a ham sandwich. Yeah, and the grand jury system is kind of a throwback, and, you know, not that good because it doesn't really push back very often at all. So that's why I didn't even go there, I think that ultimately the special counsel is responsible for this. If this is not enough evidence for you to think that Donald Trump lied, took documents he wasn't supposed to have, lied to federal authorities about it, hid them, and wasn't supposed to have them, and recklessly left them where any number of people could have read them. I just don't think that you're evidence based as a human being. You couldn't create enough evidence. He could go on national television and tell you he did it, and you'd say, oh, well, somebody made him say that. He's not really telling the truth. Some people I think what we have to face, and Fox News is a good example of this, because Fox News was caught in the Dominion case lying knowingly. They knew they lied, and yet they didn't lose their audience, because their audience likes to be lied to. They want to be lied to, and therefore they're going to be lied to. And they're just, you know, I don't know what you do with people who are not evidence-based or not fact-based. And so you're never going to give them enough evidence to make them think that Trump is guilty. They love Trump, and that's it. That stops right there.
It's been a bad week for Fox on this story anyway. At one point, they claimed it was Melania who had walked in to support her husband at the courthouse in Miami. It was somebody else who had a thin face and glasses. And then they had on their chyron the scroll underneath the split screen of Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Trump was speaking last night in Bedminster. President Biden was speaking at the very same time at the White House. So on the split screen, they had the two of them, and the scroll underneath said, "Wannabe dictator speaks at the White House after having his political rival arrested." Cass could have written that. "Wannabe dictator speaks at the White House after having his political rival arrested." They have since said that this is being dealt with, and the chyron was immediately taken down.
Chyrons always are. You know,
it's the life of a chyron.
Exactly.
You're not there very long. But they said that, okay, so they're tacitly saying that that was a mistake and somebody got their hand slapped. Brian Kilmeade, when he was introducing their coverage of the president, said, "Here now is the president of the United States." And that was deemed to be a slip of the tongue by the network as well.
I had one thing to say about the whole would wannabe dictator thing.
Go ahead.
Is I think that Trump is a wannabe dictator, and I can give you plenty of evidence for that, including the fact that he incited a mob to, you know, assault the Capitol, and that he and his henchmen arranged for fake electors to try to pretend to be real electors to keep him in office. That sounds like wannabe dictator behavior. But I think that the rhetoric on the right, and the right is extremely good at propaganda, the rhetoric on the right is to accuse their opponents of exactly what they have been accused of. And that's where you get the wannabe dictator thing. That's where you get, I mean, and I'm not even a Biden fan. I mean, I didn't want him to get the nomination, you know, in the last election. He doesn't do it for me. I think he's a moderate Democrat. I think he's kind of a traditional moderate Democrat. The idea of demonizing him and turning him into, you know, some sort of, you know, Marxist, you know, who's trying to, you know, turn all your children trans is just crazy talk that it's, you know, it's just propaganda. And it just disappoints me to see the rhetoric going that over the top. And it also scares me because it's probably fairly effective. What extremists try to do is to demonize the other side that the extremists' conduct no longer gets analyzed. That whatever the extremists do is perfectly fine because the people they're against are even worse. And I think we have that kind of level of really high rhetoric that's just corrosive for our democracy.
You do hope that the courtroom, though, will be a different arena, right? That justice will prevail. Whatever it is, justice will prevail. I do think justice has every opportunity here.
I mean, even with alien canon, I mean, you know, again, I think that judges who want to stay judges will try to act like judges. That's the thing. You know, you get this whole, you know, when Lindsey Graham said just today, he said, if there's any charges in this January 6th thing against Trump, Republicans will be infuriated because they know that if it's filed in Washington, D.C., that they couldn't possibly get a fair jury in Washington, D.C. And I thought that was a complete repudiation of our judicial system and of the, I just thought, very concept of a jury of your peers. And I don't think it was a mistake. I don't think it was an accident that he said that about an area of the country that is, you know, is half black. I think he thinks that D.C. would be hostile to Republicans. And, you know, they probably didn't vote for Republicans, most of them. But what I'm saying is that even in a deep red part of the country, and like the Florida, if they ever get to, you know, to this thing, to a courthouse, the documents case, you know, those jurors, I think, take their job seriously. And they, when they're sitting in a room with 11 other jurors and they're talking things over, I don't think they're talking about their Trump hats or I think they're trying to do a really fair, good job, mostly. And I give them credit for doing that, including the Republicans among them. I think that Americans still, unlike Lindsey Graham, Americans still want to believe in their judicial system.
Yeah.
And I give them the benefit of the doubt. I trust them to try to do a fair job.
Boy, if one of those people, though, that I saw in front of the courthouse yesterday in Miami as a juror, maybe the attorney interview weeds them out. But some of those people you think are so rock solid in their faith in Donald Trump that they would never. I mean, they know the evidence. They saw what you and I saw. They could have read what you and I read.
Just on a personal basis, I feel sorry for those people. I mean, I'm scared of those people because I think they're endangering my democracy and the future of my grandchildren. So I don't like those people. But I feel really bad for them in a way because Donald Trump doesn't give a crap about them. He does not care. They are like flies on the wall to him. He doesn't care what happens to them, yet they think that everything is wrapped up in him. It's just that the imbalance in that relationship is just stunning.
Brandon Johnson, the mayor of Chicago, do I understand correctly now, has granted the same personal leave to CPS employees as the rest of the city employees. And it's a pretty generous thing that they didn't have to win at the next negotiation over a contract. He simply said, you should have this. What? How many weeks is it? Is it 12 weeks?
12 weeks paid parental leave, which I don't think anyone would argue with the fact that 12 weeks paid parental leave is awesome for people who get 12 weeks of paid parental leave. I think the legitimate criticism of that is the fact that it wasn't bargained over. And there's a give and take that there needs to be on both sides of the government and government employees, government representing voters, people outside of government, and government employees represented by unions that only care about government employees. This wasn't something that was bargained over. This was a giveaway to his biggest campaign donor. It costs a lot of money. And whether you think that that's a good idea for all CPS employees to have that or not, that process is really problematic and I think flies in the face of like what you would expect from a representative of, you know, the taxpayers of the city. So it was very concerning. And it was a thank you for getting him into office.
Yeah.
And
I thought about you when this went down because yeah. I thought you'd say something just like that. And it certainly looks like that, maybe because it is that. But he said this shouldn't be something you have to fight over. Other Chicago city employees get this. You should have this. That you don't doesn't mean I should hold it against you and then grant you something you should have had all along at the next bargaining table while I extract something for me. It should be yours. He just gave them what they should naturally have.
There's other things that you might want to change about the nature of Chicago public schools that the Chicago Teachers Union may not want. So that's the nature of bargaining, is that you have, for example, the fact that all employees are required to live in the city of Chicago, right? A lot of Chicago public school employees would rather live just outside the boundaries or live closer to the schools where they work, but not necessarily in the city of Chicago. The Chicago Teachers Union has a vested interest in not bargaining for that because they lose a lot of their political power in city elections. That's an example of where there's a mismatch between what the union might want and what rank and file employees might want. And the purpose of the bargaining process is to say, even if you're Brandon Johnson, you think, listen, everybody in CPS deserves 12 weeks of paid leave. There might be other things you might want to change that the union doesn't necessarily want that you should bargain on behalf of all Chicagoans, of all public schools, parents and students, and even in rank and file, on behalf of rank and file teachers.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Leadership.
Yeah.
And it's a tit for tat. It's not a, and a good way to think about this is imagine if it was the other way around. Imagine if the mayor came in and said, guess what? You guys don't get 12 weeks of paid parental leave. You get zero and I'm not bargaining for it. Imagine what CTU would say about that. It's why didn't you bargain for that? CTU was complaining that the survey of whether CPS employees were vaccinated, that CPS was asking employees to take, that was not bargained for, right? That was during COVID. That was when we were deciding whether schools should open or not. So when you get something, we don't have to go through the bargaining process. But when you ask for something, oh, that's insane. Why would you not put that through the bargaining process? It's just a total imbalance of power.
And this is something Lori Lightfoot could have taken care of, too, if she saw the imbalance and thought what's right is right. We should give it to him. She never did that, right?
That clearly wasn't bargained for under Lightfoot. She could have just given it away.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But she chose not to. Maybe for that reason down the road.
Don't they have a shorter work year? I mean, because of the summer? I mean...
Well,
what I'm saying is aren't they inherently different from the rest of city employees? If they are, as far as their work rules, then they shouldn't. To me, making a sweeping judgment that everyone else gets it so they get it too doesn't make sense. So I would have to say that. I also feel like I think there's a pretty good point that's the kind of thing that you would be happy to give away, but you'd want to give it away at the bargaining table
get
so
something
you get
for
everyone
it.
Else. Yeah, so you get something for it. And I've thought with Brandon Johnson that it would the real test for him would be when he has to do something that displeases his core supporters. You know, that where he's got to really kind of bring the hammer down on people who are naturally his core supporters. And any leader in a bigger of an area is going to run into those situations where they have to do what they think is right, make an unpopular decision that hurts their supporters. And that to me is the test of a leader, is when they can do that. And so that, I don't think that point has come yet, but it's going to. I mean, it's going to, and he's either going to not do what's right in order to, you know, to please his supporters, or he's going to, you know, make an unpopular decision that might tick him off. Mm-hmm. And so that point is still has to come, but he better be equipped to do that. I mean, this was one of the main things that people were worried about when he was running for office, is that he was just going to be kowtowing to the CTU too much. Now, my personal opinion was that I would rather see somebody be favorable to CTU than to the police union, because I think the Chicago Police Union is a big problem in this city. And it almost came down to that. If you wanted to like totally oversimplify the mayoral election, it was, you know, Brandon Johnson and the CTU versus Vallis and the police union, and Brandon Johnson won. So I think that said something. But he better be willing to to not please the CTU all the time.
And I think a thought experiment to like chew on the other foot. Imagine Paul Vallis is elected mayor, and within a few weeks, every police officer gets, you know, 24 weeks of unpaid leave, right? And he doesn't go through the bargaining process to do that. People would be rightly up in arms saying, there's so much that needs to be reformed about our police department. Why? That's, maybe they deserve this, but why would you not bargain for it when there's a lot of other interests at play, not just, you know, supporters of your campaign?
No, I can't disagree with you there.
By the way, Mark, you're probably in trouble now on this podcast, because you said that teachers don't work all year round. And that gets a lot of people in trouble when they say that.
I'm totally pro-teacher. My older daughter is a teacher, and I'm really proud of her. The way I understand it, you're not required to work in the summer unless you want to, and you get paid extra for it. I don't know what CT. I don't know the city rules. My daughter teaches out in the suburbs.
My son works for CPS, and he doesn't have. He's not working this summer. He's not getting paid this summer.
So why would anyone be ticked off about that?
Because teachers work really hard, and those you people who say that they just go to school hours and they get Christmas vacation and summer off, you don't know how hard it is. They work all. You've never heard that argument or conversation?
Oh, yeah, but I believe they work really hard, and they buy some of their own supplies, and they work. Yeah. I know my daughter and her colleagues, they work on the weekends sometimes, and they work at night, and they go to events, and you know, no, I don't think being a teacher is a hard job. Plus, you deal with ticked off parents. It's not. I mean, what my daughter always says is that she's there for the kids. And if it wasn't for the kids, she's, you know, the administration and the parents and everything like that, you know, that's part of the job. But if the kids are the pleasure and the reason that she's in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, so I love teachers. I never understand why we don't have more respect for teachers. I mean, all of us, I think, can think of a teacher in our youth who made a real difference in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was a teacher who called my BS. Who was, you know, I was always good in school and always, you know, wrote really well, and everyone just gave me an A, and that was it. And this one teacher one time said, "What is this? This is not very good. You have written a bunch of words, but they're not. I mean, really, just took me down. And here I am." You know, 40, 50 years later, remembering it. And it made a difference. So, I mean, I have a great respect for teachers, but that doesn't mean that they need to get, you know, a big, you know, bouquet just because a new guy got elected.
That's an interesting way to put it. Interestingly, my son, who works for Chicago Public Schools, doesn't like the kids, but he loves the administrators and parents and loves getting into disciplinary issues and rules and procedures.
You know, John, but in school, weren't you in school sometimes when you wondered, there were certain teachers who you really thought did not like the kids?
Oh, I mean, sure. Yeah.
That always blew me away. I never understood, why would you become a teacher if you didn't like the kids? But I always ran across some teachers who you just got the vibe that they thought the kids were the problem in school.
I think that hurts the teaching profession and other teachers in the workplace as much as children, because I'm sure you guys have worked in work environments where there's people who are terrible and somehow keep their job. It demoralizes everybody. Oh, yeah, it affects the work product of everybody. And a good example of something you might want to trade or reform for 12 weeks of paid parental leave would be something around disciplinary procedures or reviews, or, you know, any of these things that are extreme, you know, third rail things for the Chicago Teachers Union. Maybe those are some of the kinds of things that would benefit all teachers that you would want to discuss at the bargaining table for
and
something like
that. Aren't most school administrators teachers to begin with? You know who I feel sorry for sometimes, or I think has a really hard job, is the school superintendent. And I know they get a lot of money and a lot of them retire with great packages, but whenever I go to an event, I went over to the local high school and I was watching the boys play baseball on one field and the girls play softball on another field. And I think it was like 5 or 6 o'clock on a Friday. And there was the superintendent walking around, you know, just being part of that scene. And I thought, this is a guy who may want to go home. This kid isn't out on the field. It was just parents watching the games, you know. But no, there was the superintendent there. He's at the basketball games on a Tuesday night at 9 o'clock.
Austin, it's a tough thing if you're for a union to be in that situation. I understand your point. It cuts both ways, because you can have a situation where if you make disciplinary procedures too easy to fire teachers, you might get, you know, some retribution on somebody who just kind of said one thing bad to the principal, whatever, or they get fired so that the principal's friend can get in. I mean, you want to avoid abuses. But at the same time, you're right. You don't want to protect incompetent or just nasty teachers. So, I mean, it's tough. It doesn't go one way or the other. I think that it's in the city of Chicago. I can understand why some people think that the CTU is too much of a kind of a political entity as opposed to just a traditional workers union. And you know, that may well be true, but you know, it is a city in which clout is respected and very little else is.
Speaking of Paul Vallis is now working with your organization, the Illinois Policy Institute. I don't know if he's working with you guys or for you guys. Is he on the payroll? What's his role here?
We just announced Paul on, what was it, Monday, as a new senior policy advisor for the Illinois Policy Institute. I think it's a great match. His campaign was really not a partisan campaign in any way. It was not about one party versus another. I guess the race is officially nonpartisan, so even if he wanted to make it that, he couldn't.
Right.
But really ran on issues, and he's an issues guy, and he's a policy wonk guy. And he has deep expertise on the issues that we really care about, the Illinois Policy Institute, and he really ran on those, whether it was on a reasonable approach to public safety or on a reasonable approach to budgeting, or especially as he has done for, you know, the last 30 years of his career, being such a vocal proponent of the right of every child to choose the school that's best for them. And he has serious expertise on those matters. And I think I'm really happy that he joined forces with the Institute, because I think his voice is an important one for the future of the city of Chicago. And after all, the man got 48% of the vote. So he brought together a really interesting coalition of Chicagoans who care about these kinds of issues.
Your organization, the Illinois Policy Institute, is a right-leaning one. And one of the charges against him in the election was, well, you're really a Republican. You just say you're a Democrat. And now, lo and behold, he's working for you guys. Am I to make anything of that relationship now, or the confirmation of that?
I think it's about the issues. I mean, even in his statement, Paul is a lifelong Democrat. That is absolutely true. And I think his party has moved away. I think his party has moved away from him a lot more than he has moved away from the party. I really believe that to be true. And again, it's like, this guy cares about the issues that we care about. And I think it's a misperception about the Illinois Policy Institute that's like, you know, it's fighting for right wing type of issues, because we make Republicans as mad as Democrats. We make Republicans mad when we talk about police accountability. We make Republicans mad when we talk about budgets that pass that are unbalanced, that are not fixing the pension problem. There was a Republican state representative that challenged one of our policy researchers to a fist fight because he didn't like how he was framing up the budget. We really, really care about issues. We care about growing Illinois and making it a great place to live, to thrive, to grow a business, to raise a family. And we will work with anyone who shares those ideas, regardless of whether they say they are representative of a particular political party.
You may make Republicans angry, but I'll bet you make Democrats angrier. I mean,
depends on which ones.
Well, I know, but if it's Rob Blagojevich as a Democrat, that's different. There are a lot of different. Yes, there are a lot of different people of different stripes that call themselves Republicans and Democrats. But it was really interesting, John. I don't know if you're on Twitter or not, but and Austin, I don't know whether you saw this, but as soon as that was announced, all the Democrats or the left wing leaning people were, aha, he finally declared himself to be.
He admitted it.
Yeah, it was actually kind of funny just how quickly just everyone jumped up and said, aha.
But do you think this is true about most Illinoisans? Democrats have been running the state forever, and most Illinoisans are not happy with how the state is run. I'm one of these people who would like to see some sort of sea change in how our state is run. And I don't know if that makes me wish more Republicans were elected, but I'm not happy with the job that the Democrats have been doing.
It depends who you're talking. Are you talking about Madigan Democrats, or are you talking about Pritzker Democrats?
I'm sure there's a difference.
A big difference. Okay. I think there's an enormous difference. I sure know that a legislature run by Mike Madigan was a real problem in this state. I mean, according to the feds, it was a criminal problem. So, that needs to be fixed. I guess the question whether the party of Darren Bailey is the party to fix it.
Boy, talk about the party going one direction and the candidate going another. He got whooped in the primary, in the general election. He was able to win in a primary because he was so extreme and had a zillion dollars behind him. But clearly that's not what Illinois wanted. That doesn't play in Illinois, does it, Austin?
You have to think about the fixing Illinois is about getting the wrong people to do the right thing. And Illinois policy for a long time drew attention to Mike Madigan and what was clearly corruption, what was clearly an abuse of power, and what was clearly doing harm to the people of the state. And I personally was called in the tank for the right wing all the time. All of us were personally attacked because we just hate Democrats and we want to, take everybody's rights away and like all this crazy stuff because we were holding power to account in a very effective way. And that's the same thing that's now happening with CTU, where it's like, this is the new political machine in our state, and it does not have the best interests of all the people in the state in mind. It has political power and unlike Madigan, a very extreme ideology that it's also pushing. So we will continue to hold that power to account and continue to tell people what the consequences of that power are. Now, in some cases, would it be better to vote for a Republican candidate than a Democrat to get them out of office and to hold them to account and to change things? Absolutely. In some cases, it might be better to vote for a Democrat to get that person out of office. It depends. And it frankly doesn't matter to me. It's about holding power to account and making sure that political machines aren't running the state.
Yeah, but beyond corruption, you make a great point there, and I completely agree with it. But beyond corruption, there are policy issues to be dealt with. There's the abortion issue, for example. And there you have a clear majority of the residents of Illinois wanting abortion rights. And you have a Republican Party that doesn't, and you have a Democratic Party that does. So on some really distinct and meaningful policy issues, I think you have a Democratic Party that is more in line with what the majority of the people of the state want. And that is totally separate from the fact that the Mike Madigan machine was just a pox on Illinois politics for a quarter of a century.
You mentioned Rob Blagojevich. Eric Zorn, who normally is on this panel, mentioned that at the state capitol, when Bruce Rauner returned to the capitol this week to unveil his portrait and then made some self-deprecating remarks about it, also said, well, not all the governors are in jail, which I don't know how funny that was or appropriate that was, but he said it. Blagojevich is twice elected portrait does not hang in the state capitol. I guess by law, did the legislature not pass something that said that it will not hang in the capitol? Eric asked people how they feel about that. We did too on our news click, and it was 50-50. Half of our people said, whatever you make of Blagojevich, he was our twice elected governor. His picture should hang in the capitol. Austin, go.
Should it hang there? I feel like I'm going to discover what my answer is in this conversation, because on one hand, you know, this is like the statues debate, right? Like, these people are an important part of history. Is it good that they are out in the open so that people can learn about them and they're in some kind of prominent place? On the other hand, by hanging up a portrait or by making a statue, you are implicitly honoring this person's deeds and their life and what they stood for and all these mm-hmm. things. And by doing so, are you setting a terrible example for people in how they conduct themselves, right? So, I mean, honestly, the best thing to do in Illinois when it comes to honoring political figures would be to, if the odds are that they're not good, so just put a blanket ban, just everybody, nobody gets anything. Like, nobody's
no
getting
portraits.
Nobody gets pizza, right? Like, you, we're turning this car around. Like, nobody gets any statues. Nobody gets any plaques. It's like, there's been too much. We've gotten burned too many times. So let's just assume, like, the worst. That's what, I guess that's what my opinion is. No more portraits.
You ruin it for everybody, Rod.
Yeah.
Three governors that preceded him, the three most recently that preceded him who did go to jail, do have their portraits hanging there.
Yeah. That seems silly to me. I mean, of course, Blagojevich was arising out of official duties, but that's a perfect example of this. It's like there's some weird line that you can cross.
yeah. Okay.
Well, I mean, Ryan was official duties, but not as governor.
Right, right.
But I guess my view of it would be that I think they should all hang there, but I think they should have, you know, little, you know, one or two sentence explainers under them. And that would be the place to put them in context, in historical context. You know, you could say, you know, positive things for governors who did things positively, but that's right there. You could say, you know, was Rob Blagojevich was impeached because he tried to, you know, sell a sentence.
Yeah, right. There's no context now. I mean, it's a timeline that's incomplete. Better you have his timeline, his two terms represented, his right. term and a half represented, and then tell us, by the way, this guy went to jail.
You know, that's why, I mean, that's why I'm not for melting down the Confederate general statues either. I mean, I don't think they need to necessarily be in prominent places like we think they're great or anything. But, you know, putting them someplace where they can be viewed as historical works of art and can be explained what they were, why they were, to me is important. You know, I'm not for like a destroying history. I'm just for putting it in context.
I like the museum. It's a museum approach versus a Hall of Fame or right. or an honor. That right. makes the most sense, I think.
So then now that you've talked yourself out of or into, where are you then on this?
I'm on the museum, the Hall of, we'll just call it.
Shame, Governors. The Hall of Shame.
The Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame and Shame.
So wait, so you're actually going to close that wing of the Capitol, I believe, is what you decided to do, that nobody gets a pizza.
No, I think I like Mark's approach where if you add context, or maybe we could have like a big asterisk.
Just a giant asterisk.
You could put a red line through it, like all the ones that are, maybe put bars up in front of his, superimpose some bars in front of it.
Or you could have like a tomato kind of, like it'd been thrown right. at the portrait, dripping off of the framed picture.
You could draw a mustache.
Just one last thing then. So, well, it was Alexei Janulius, wasn't it, who was behind the banning, the book ban, and the governor signed that into law. Do I remember that correctly? That was isn't he the official librarian of the state of Illinois? So that was really his baby. And so Illinois now has sort of the distinction of being the state that bans book bans. That's a good thing, right?
My initial reaction to that was, I don't even know if it's necessary, you know, that there's not a problem in the state so far. And, you know, why? I don't know. It just seemed like just letting people, you know, letting librarians operate sounds like a good idea to me.
It's a little, I think it's a lot of sizzle with not much steak. And we should obviously have as much information as possible available to the children of Illinois. Nobody disagrees. But This isn't actually a ban on book bans. It just says if you're a library, you have to sign this policy that I think is from the American Library Association or something of that sort, that says you cannot remove books for, quote, partisan or doctrinal reasons.
Right.
And it cuts state funding if you, the library, doesn't sign this thing. But if the library doesn't enforce the policy of the thing, there isn't a punishment. I guess somebody could maybe sue and you could maybe get some damages or something under state law. But I don't think it's actually going to change much in terms of how libraries are operating most of the state. I think it was, you know, kind of a big PR opportunity in a long march of J.B. Pritzker trying to cast himself in exact opposition to Ron DeSantis. And this is a thing Ron DeSantis is talking about. And so J.B. Pritzker is going to do the opposite thing and try to get a lot of media on that.
It did strike me as maybe a solution looking for a problem, but it was a solution that didn't bother me, so I wasn't against it. What really kind of shocked or bothered me about this kind of story was the poem that was read at Biden's inauguration was turned into a book, and that was banned from an elementary school in Florida. A parent who hadn't read the whole book but found a passage on two of the pages, which were innocuous, said, "I think this is dangerous. Kids shouldn't read it." Kind of scrawled a signature at the end. It was about two sentences on a form, and that got that book removed from the shelves of the grade school at a school district in Florida. It was too easy. I do see why what we did in Illinois has a little cultural traction right now, because that is crazy that poem that was read at Biden's inauguration would be deemed inappropriate for grade schoolers. That's just nuts, says me. Okay, Mark, it's always a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thanks for giving us some of your time and all of your thoughts today.
Thanks for the invitation.
And Austin, good to see you too, my friend.
Good to see you.
We are produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week. All right. Thanks, guys.
Talk to you later.
See ya.
See ya.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.